From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Winston Churchill said that every young man is a liberal and every old man a conservative. John Kenneth Galbraith defies that truism. At 94, he still stands tall for the liberal economic perspective that made him one of the best-known economists on Earth. This hour, we're collecting the wit and wisdom of the grand old man himself, John Kenneth Galbraith. I spoke with John Kenneth Galbraith earlier today at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he was good enough to invite On Point for a conversation in his Bookline study. What does the man who has seen it all from FDR's New Deal to 9/11 think about America's power and policies today? At 6'8", he still cuts an imposing, keen-eyed figure. John Kenneth Galbraith settled into his favorite chair and looked out on Enron, the U.S. economy, and a world grappling with a new kind of war. Professor Galbraith, we're so honored to be speaking with you. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Today, of course, it's 6 months since September 11th, also almost 6 months since Enron first came on the public's screen as a large issue. In those 6 months, the world has been so focused on terror and war and the economy. The New York Times columnist Paul Krugman said in a recent column that ultimately the Enron scandal will be seen as more significant in the eyes of history than September 11th. We want to talk about both the economy and the war on terror today, but what do you make of that formulation?
Well, he's a very acute and clever man, but I wouldn't attribute quite that ranking, although Enron was certainly very important and is very important, even as we talk today. The level of activity of a questionable sort, you notice how careful I am in my language.
I do.
Was spectacular in that case. And since I make some pretense to economics, it was the one that came in most strongly on me. I had for years taught about corporations, but I was never prepared for anything quite so ridiculous, quite so fantastic as Enron.
What do you think created the corporate culture that allowed Enron to happen?
Oh, I would say there were several things. First, there has always been a big concession to corporate power. It has been assumed that the corporation is slightly above criticism, taken for granted, and doesn't have the close critical attention that even an individual would expect. And there is also the deference that is paid to economics and to economics activity, and one hopes to economics success. And there's also the whole structure of community prestige, something that Texans have always been looking for, sometimes for good reason.
You've written that capitalism punishes those who it seems most to reward. What did you mean by that? And is that dynamic at play with Enron today?
Oh, without a doubt. Enron was featured as a success. I must say, not in my thinking, because to my dissatisfaction, I didn't know much about it. But it was certainly one of the skyrocketing examples of what we expect in what is called the free enterprise system. Nothing there was free. And as a result, brought a level of attention to its misbehavior, its questionable activity. You notice I avoid stronger words.
I do notice that.
That nobody ever really expected. And where there is sort of a natural protection that one doesn't, without evidence, attack an institution or an economic privileged person without some evidence.
Is there something about the boom culture of the 1990s that might have, or did, encourage what we saw in Enron? You wrote in your great book on the 1929 crash, the Great Crash, in the 50s, that the chance for a recurrence of a speculative orgy remains good. You said, during any future boom, some newly rediscovered virtuosity of the free enterprise system will be cited. Was there something in the air in the 90s that led to the great run-up of the stock market, that led to Enron? Was the new economy a new kind of elixir of illusion, or was there something real there?
I had forgotten that I said that. And you attribute it to me a prescience that I really didn't have. All I had was the knowledge that at intervals of anywhere from 10 to 15 years, we have an accumulation in the economy of misbehavior, which leads to something of a crisis. We had it in the early part of this century, and we had it again in the 1930s. And then we had this extraordinary example in recent times. And I had emphasized that recurrent tendency rather than any particular event. I think it also has to be said that Enron was a footnote to history as compared to what happened before 1929 and after. That was a major step in the history of capitalism, or as we now prefer, the free enterprise system, where nothing is free.
But that was a major step in the 20s that you've been very critical of, as having set the United States up for a decade of suffering in the Great Depression.
Absolutely. The 29 crash, I don't think it's fair to say that it caused the Depression, but time and history being what it is, it ushered it in. And so the combination of the Great Crash and the Great Depression have always been linked together in analysis as they were by history.
You've written in your writings on the Great Crash how it was a long time in unfolding, that people didn't realize fully what was going on as it happened, that it took longer than people ever expected for the full impact to be felt. Do you see any parallels with today? Are we at risk of some comparable economic meltdown, or as the economists, the contemporary economists are often saying, are we now nearly out of this recession and back onto a growth track?
Nobody knows, and I wouldn't pretend to know. But I don't think there is anything as quite as bad now as there was in the great speculative explosion of the late 20s. That was a time of really incredible insanity. And I can't think that that's being repeated. But on the other hand, you can't go into the history of Enron, which I confess I haven't done before it cracked up, without seeing how incredibly foolish people can be and still seem to be getting away with it.
Professor Galbraith, when you look at the excitement that fueled the stock market run-up of the 1990s, all the talk of the information age, the new economy, you've written disdainfully about the 20s as a period when there was a lot of hucksterism behind the claims to something new. Do you see something historically new in the 90s as new technology permits a new degree of networking of the entire world?
Absolutely not. The underlying circumstance is common and recurrent. That is, people owning property, owning stock, in this case, seeing it go up in value on the market and are immediately susceptible to some argument that it is inherent in the system, that there has been some change, that history has turned in their favor. That has always been true. And the way in which you can persuade people as to the virtue and rationale of an event which is good for them. And that has been true for a long succession of crises, going back now for almost two centuries, and was true in 1929, and has been wonderfully true in these last months and years, particularly in a firm like Enron. But there have been others.
But is it always an illusion? Is it possible that there are, at some points, new developments, new technologies that do change the dynamic of an economy? Or is it timeless?
Oh, there may be. But I would insist strongly on one point, that they mostly exist in the minds of people wanting something to believe that justifies their seeming increase in wealth. They want to believe that history and the economy is on their side, undeserving as they may be.
The 90s were dominated by the ideas of market liberalization and free trade, with the United States as the main proponent of both. Is it working?
Oh, I think it has, yes. I'm not in favor of acute protectionism that sometimes is justified. Sometimes there's in some cases, worthwhile. But I adhere to one of the basic precepts of my profession, my alleged profession, which is that on the whole, markets and free trade are, in the longer run, constructive forces. I don't go around making speeches against the market.
How about the level of deregulation that the economy has seen during that same decade?
Oh, there's no question that was a mistake. The people who find a regulation inconvenient never say it. That's why they're against it, or very rarely. What they say is that it's socially bad, that it's socially inappropriate, that it's socially restrictive and depression-making. And we had an outbreak of that in recent times, and it did two things. It removed regulations that might have been appropriate in the case of something like Enron. And it justified the keeping and the position of those who were doing well, those who were in it for the money. And there is a footnote, too. One must have one bit of admiration for the Enron and the associated developments. They had a scale of operations that one couldn't possibly imagine. What was a few thousand dollars for some people was a million, 2 millions, 100 million for those chaps. And one is astonished at the scale of their operations.
This was not pocket change.
They were not given to pocket change.
We'll return in just a moment to our conversation with John Kenneth Galbraith. The conversation was recorded earlier today, so we aren't taking calls this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Professor John Kenneth Galbraith in his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Galbraith, the stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression led to a sweeping disappointment with capitalism. The setbacks of recent years to the economy, of the last couple of years, don't seem to have been nearly as severe, obviously, as you say, and don't seem to have led to much of a rethinking. What's your view of the general economic path that the United States is on as we go toward freer and freer markets and toward a more and more globalized economy?
Well, the main thing to have in mind was back in the early part of the last century, up through 1929 and after, there seemed to be a plausible alternative to the market system, to capitalism. That position has diminished, and the dominant doctrine now is we have to make the best and do the best and do what is necessary for the basic system we have. That's the big change. Coupled with the inevitable counterpart that there's now a confidence in the market system which can withstand and will withstand misfortunes like the whole Enron development and the effect that that is having on other equally idiotic developments in the system.
Do you share that confidence? You coined the phrase conventional wisdom, and of course today the conventional wisdom is that the system is strong and it will, as you say, withstand these blows. Is there any reason to be concerned or to doubt that?
Oh, there's no question of that good times and favorable treatment by the economy are the great, great sources of false attitudes. The persuasion that it comes from doing well is one of the great facts of human nature. And that is quite possibly true at the present time. But on the other hand, for what it may be worth, I don't see anything quite as vulnerable as the 1920s, for example, or occasional episodes since. But when I say the 1920s, I mean leading on to the 1930s. I don't make my career out of the pessimism that should have been exercised in the late 1920s.
You were part of the design team for Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. Of course, at the heart of that was the idea of security for American people economically. What do you think FDR would make of our economy, our world, today?
Oh, there's no question about that. He would do whatever was necessary to attract legally and properly a huge political following. He did not have a consistent, unchanged political view or economic view. He had a wonderful capacity to identify with the serviceable action or the popular action. One can't go back to that period without admiring the selection of legislation that he used to advance his own and the country's position.
So FDR was looking for what would be popular, what would make him a successful politician.
I would put it a little different. I would say he was open to that. He was open to anything that, by way of improving the economy, would improve his leadership.
And what would he make of the state of the American economy and its treatment of the whole range of American citizens, rich and poor, today?
I think he would find the state of well-being in the Republic much easier to associate with, much less dramatic in what it required than it did at the end of the 1920s. The underlying institutions now, although not without fault, there are many faults, are much better than they were in 1928, 1929, 1930.
And what do you make of the health of the U.S. economy right now? There's a lot of talk about recovery. There seems to be a recovery underway. Does it look like we could be back into healthy growth soon? Are you following it closely?
I have a iron-bound rule, and that is not to join the thousands who impressively make the wrong predictions. We could have, as a result of Enron, as a result of weaknesses elsewhere in the economy, as a result of a whole range of conditions having to do with technical development in corporations, a quite bad situation. And we could have possibly overcome that and continue to solve the worst problem of our economy, and that is the incredibly bad distribution of income and the incredibly excess income going at to the top of the economy. We could have that change, see it more clearly, this need more clearly, and have a period of stability and growth. I consciously, deliberately avoid any prediction as to which it will be, partly because I don't know, and more because nobody else does.
You have always been very vigilant in watching income distribution in the United States, and you've often spoke against the heavy concentration of income and wealth at the top of the scale. You've also written and spoken against tax cuts for the wealthy. Now we have both heavy income concentration at the top and recently tax cuts for the wealthy. What's wrong with this formula in your mind?
It's very inconsistent with an equitable position in the larger society. The best economy is the one which treats everybody as much alike as their personal contribution allows. We have a bad distribution of income, which could be a frail point for the system as a whole. And I'm not pessimistic, but I don't think we should ever lose sight of the fact that the good economy is one that has a generally equitable reward for all of its participants.
Let's turn to September 11th, if we may. What do you make of the terrorist attacks of that day? Everyone has asked since then, why did this happen? What's your assessment?
Well, my assessment is less magnificent than some. I think this was an operation of a relatively small group in the world who saw that opening, exploited it. I don't think it was a characterization of the great masses of the people of the economic, political world. And therefore, for what it may be worth, and I'm not appealing to any satisfaction in my own commitment to the future, but for what it may be worth, I don't think this was the first step in any major similar disaster. I think it was the extraordinary effort of a relatively small criminal class.
In that case, what do you think of the Bush administration's global war on terror, which has been its response?
I think there were two things. I think on behalf of George Bush, whom I don't ordinarily support with great enthusiasm, there was the need to see this as a shocking thing, a frightening thing for the American people. And I'm very much afraid also that he saw or came to see how the world war on terrorism, consolidates a political position, and it did, and has. And I'm in favor of seeing this as a miserable manifestation of modern life, but I'm not in favor of seeing it as the basis for political support or action.
You said that Bush may have felt a need to respond in terms of war to this for political reasons. Why so?
Oh, there's no question. The American people, and this is true of other countries, have an inbuilt lesson that they must come together in a cohesive way in when the word war is used. That was true of World War I, World War II particularly, and was exploited even on the lesser conflicts since, unsuccessfully in the case of Vietnam. And that's the resort of any politician who is in a position of political weakness is to have that word come to his defense.
You were almost middle-aged when Pearl Harbor took place. September 11th has been widely compared with Pearl Harbor. Do you see any appropriate parallels there?
Oh, sure. That's what I was just saying, that the word war brings a sense of unity and an agreement on purpose like nothing else.
So Pearl Harbor gave FDR the platform to bring the nation to war.
I was in Washington at the time. I went to the great meeting in Knudsen's office the night of Pearl Harbor, and I was struck, as everybody was, that the contending positions in the administration in the New Deal were being, on that very evening, put aside. I remained a New Dealer. But the war, like for me, the war, like everybody else, became the dominant problem to which one surrendered his views to some extent.
So the structure, the language of war may have political utility to the Bush administration. What do you make of it as a national strategy in response to the attacks of September 11th?
Well, I don't think it was any national strategy. I think that in defense of George Bush, it has to be said that he just drifted in with the obvious, that that's what war does, consolidates opinion. And he accepted that. And since he'd been having trouble before, including a somewhat damaging tendency in the economy and in economic policy, moved to that suddenly, strongly, and the reward was a much greater support than he would otherwise have had.
Now the administration has pushed through very large increases in U.S. military spending. what do you expect the consequences of those increases will be?
Well, those will be support to the economy. This is what somebody has called military Keynesianism, putting the government on the side of expenditure and employment and new business activity. And I think that having been on the edge of a serious recession, that this was one of the expanding factors as far as the economy was concerned.
Is it a substitute, then, for a stimulus package that Congress has been asked to provide? Is it just as good?
It's not as good, because I want a stimulus package which reflects the needs of people here in the United States and abroad. And war and preparation for war, armament, doesn't do that. Let us be quite clear on that. But that it can have the same employment and the same expansive economic effect is entirely possible, entirely to be expected.
The case has been made that global inequities may in some way be behind the animosity that led to September 11th. You've written and spoken so much of the income distribution within the United States. How should Americans think about the importance of the distribution of wealth and income, of quality of life globally?
That's a very good question. And when I say a question is good, that's so exceptional that you should relax and smile.
Okay, I will.
I think there's no question that that is true. And I think also going a step further, there's one point about which we should be concerned, and that is the danger, the real danger that we use international crises as a stimulant for our own economy. I want to see our economy, when it needs a stimulant, as it often does, respond to a welfare, a kindness, a humane need, and not to sending soldiers into battle, or nowadays sending airplanes to bomb innocent people.
We'll return to our conversation with John Kenneth Galbraith in just a moment. This conversation was recorded earlier today, so we aren't taking calls this hour. To read John Kenneth Galbraith's bio or to view a 360-degree photograph of today's interview in his home, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with John Kenneth Galbraith. Professor Galbraith, just over the weekend, it has emerged that the Bush administration is reconsidering the United States policy on nuclear weapons. While the details are still a bit unclear, it seems that there is a larger readiness to signal to the world, perhaps a greater readiness to use nuclear weapons than had previously been the case. Does this seem necessary to you, or how do you judge it?
There are times when even on a radio program, one should be categorical. That is alarming because it is very unwise. We've been saved since World War II by the extraordinary good fortune that has kept nuclear weapons out of use. And this is very important to continue, because it is something on which survival of all of us depends. I was director of the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey at the end of World War II here and in Japan. It left me with an enduring worry, an enduring impression of the cruelty of bombing, as we did it in Germany and Japan. But it also left me with an overwhelming impression of the danger to civilization that comes from nuclear warfare, the total danger.
And yet, the bar seems to be lowered a bit by this new policy.
I would be against the policy. Use your phrase, I would be strongly, I am strongly against anything that lowers that barrier. And the people who talk that way should realize it too.
You have watched the interplay of economies and nations for a long time now. On this six-month observance of 9/11, we're all looking for perspective. What are the most important things we need to be thinking about in terms of our attitudes toward the national economy, the global economy, human culture in this new century, to steer away from the kinds of conflicts that we now see ourselves in?
We must see that the relationship between peace and human survival has never been closer, and that we must see conflict, not only of nuclear conflict, but of any modern warfare, as something which human survival requires. And that must have a preeminent authority in our policy and our thought.
Do you see the globalization of the world economy pushing us closer to peace? Is it a force for peace? Or might it be pursued differently that would make it more effective in bringing peace?
I don't see any dangerous movement from globalization to war. And I think on the whole, bringing countries together through trade, social intercourse, intellectual intercourse, is one of the great peacemaking activities of our time. And there are spectacular examples of how successful that can be. I was born and brought up in Canada. There was a time then in my youth when there was tension between the two countries. A great campaign in Canada in 1911 was fought on the doctrine of no truck or trade with the Yankees. And we've seen how agreeable that relationship has become over the years. Minor problems here and there, but nothing that arouses tension. And that's the kind of world I want to live in. And that's the kind of world that is destroyed by military and certainly by nuclear fears.
You've written and spoken about the unfinished business of the 20th century. What do you think are the most important unfinished tasks now?
Oh, no question. I'd be repeating myself. The lingering commitment to military disaster.
What do you mean by that?
That we haven't extruded from thought and action the possibility of war, including increasingly devastating war.
And yet only in these 6 months we've leapt to the word war in response to an attack.
That is something which I very much regret. I think to some extent we used war as the cover for other needs, including a measure of public unity that it brings along with much higher costs, much higher dangers. I think we must all agree, or should all agree, that war now has the possibility of ending all civilized life.
John Kenneth Galbraith, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
That was a conversation recorded earlier today with the great economist John Kenneth Galbraith. Jack Beatty, I know he's a personal hero of yours, and there, at age 94, still standing tall at 6'8" and an enormous presence in any room that he enters in every dimension, there's the man.
He said to you, I make some pretense to economics.
some slight pretense.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the great public men of the post-war era. I mean, there's just no question about it. The depth and range of his contribution to intellectual life, public life, it's just unrivaled. I mean, he has been the past president of both the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Economic Association. Economics is the dismal science. And this man, for an entire generation, brought it alive with one of the most elegant and urbane literary styles of the century. I mean, ask yourself if you'd rather, for sheer literary pleasure, read a page of Norman Mailer or John Kenneth Galbraith. Hands down, pick Galbraith.
And he's an economist that will make you laugh even as he illuminates the world.
And here's a sample sentence. We have far more people selling derivatives, index funds, and mutual funds than there is intelligence for the task.
I was reading over the weekend The Great Crash, and he's writing about Charles Ponzi of the Ponzi scheme of Boston, and who sold – there was a great Florida land rush, sort of a scam, and he was selling land. He called it near Jacksonville. Of course, it was 65 miles west of Jacksonville, Florida. And Galbraith notes, in other respects, Ponzi believed in good, compact neighborhoods. He sold 23 lots to the acre. but here he is describing the war as a politically convenient development for President George W. Bush.
I think that's a matter of fact. The president's more and more of the public was identifying him as basically a president governing for the affluent and for the corporations, and governing really against the environmental necessities of the future. And that was the emerging view of him in August of last year. And this war, I don't mean it as cruelly as it sounds, but it was, I think, a political deliverance for him.
And yet, everyone wanted a response to 9/11. You look at John Kenneth Galbraith with the experience of a century behind him, stating at the end, we've got to get away from war as the response. He's 94, and I'm not sure that urgent rejection of war will survive him with the fervor that he holds today.
Yes, and it's been throughout his career. There's nothing more poignant than a book of his letters to President Kennedy written while he was ambassador to India, warning President Kennedy of the dangers ahead in the commitment to Vietnam. It is tragically prescient. He saw far in advance. This is 1961, 62, 63. He saw far in advance what was coming. And if only the president had listened.
If only he'd listened then, of course, Vietnam ensued, and we didn't have a chance to talk, but we all look ahead from this six-month mark and wonder what exactly is brewing today.
Yeah.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour, and thanks for your thoughts on John Kenneth Galbraith.
Well, it was a great pleasure to hear that great man.
It was a great pleasure to sit with him this afternoon. Today marks the sixth month anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Solemn ceremonies and moments of silence were observed throughout the nation. We end the program tonight with sounds from commemorations in New York and Washington, D.C.
Six months separate us from September the 11th. Yet for the families of the lost, each day brings new pain. Each day requires new courage. Your grace and strength have been an example to our nation. America will not forget the lives that were taken and the justice their death requires.
Mark the time in which we knew that we had been attacked. and that we had been attacked in a way unlike any other way in which America had ever been attacked before. This was the worst violation of America in our history. And in the moments that it was taking place and thereafter for some time, I wondered, could we endure it? Could we handle it? Could we get through it? And shortly after, during the first day, I realized that your loved ones gave us the example on which we would build. I realized that we had won the war against terrorism on that first day. We're now winning the battles, but we won the war because of their bravery, their strength, their unwillingness to retreat in the face of the worst attack that we as Americans had ever seen. The firefighters and the police officers stood there in the hallways. They stood there in the lobby. So did the rescue workers and the emergency workers and many, many hidden heroes, the citizens, the civilians we might not know about who helped others. So it's to them that we dedicate everything that we do in the future. And it's to them that we have to look for our inspiration and for our sense of purpose. They would want us to lift up our heads very, very high. They would want us to move forward as a people who live in freedom with strength and determination that ultimately this country will prevail as it always has.
But from the ashes, hope springs. With the coming of spring, the Pentagon building is rising, and thanks to the truly outstanding effort of the workers, repairs are ahead of schedule. Indeed, from the outside, the building looks like it's almost new.
Exactly 6 months ago, on Tuesday, September 11th, New York City came under attack. We are here today to dedicate this memorial to those we lost. World peace through free trade was the inspiration for the Sphere, which once stood at the World Trade Center. It survived the collapse of the Twin Towers, as did the idea that catalyzed its creation, a peaceful world based on trade and the free movement of people and ideas. The Sphere may be damaged, but our belief in the principles it represents have never been stronger. That is what we stand for as New Yorkers, as we always have in the past, and as we always will in the future.
That was President Bush, Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Rumsfeld, and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, marking the six-month observance of September 11th, 2001. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.